The ancient scriptures speak in a triple voice, and therefore, in the study of this great lore, we have to employ the triple method of interpretation and evaluation. It is especially the case with such deep and comprehensive spiritual literature as the Vedas, the Upanishads, and the Bhagavad Gita, for instance. It is for a want of this comprehensive approach to the subject of these great reservoirs of knowledge that many exponents have emphasized one or other aspect of the great teachings, and we see divergences among these interpretations of the scripture. This situation has arisen on account of the exponents not paying due attention to the multifaceted form of supernormal wisdom. The wisdom of life, or the knowledge of the spirit as we are sometimes given to understand, is not ordinary scientific knowledge or an empirical understanding of the things of the world. There is a great difference between the normal human approach to things in matters of day-to-day life and the approach that is requisite in matters that are supernatural. There are things which man cannot understand with his intellect, and even the best of human equipments called logic will not be of much help where superhuman truths are involved, because logic is a human instrument and superhuman realms cannot be approached through any endowment of the human understanding merely. We have therefore to put on a newer attitude of greater humility in such matters that seem to be beyond the ken of our perception, and all seekers of knowledge were humble aspirants who always were open to rectification and correction and teaching, who never assumed a preconceived notion of having mastered things already, because what we do not know is much vaster than what we already know. Therefore, we come to a point in our later life, especially when we begin to realize, to our great discomfort and discomfiture, that the larger part of our life has been spent in the acquisition of a knowledge which does not seem to be of much help to us in times of difficulty. And then it is that we turn to gurus and masters and yogis and adepts and go to institutions, study the Gita and the Upanishads and the Vedas and what not. But then our physical life in this world is naturally limited, and we go with a wry face of dissatisfaction of having learnt very little, perhaps almost nothing. But it is not necessary that we all should go crying from this world if only we are sure that we are blessed with
this premonition of such a situation arising in everyone's life, and nature's laws exempt none, not even the best of men. Everyone has to tread the same route to perfection, and everyone has to confront the same problems and difficulties. We have thus to proceed with great caution and enter into a field of a newer type of study for purpose of bringing about a thoroughgoing reorientation of our thought, to bring about a rebirth, as it were, into the spirit of right understanding. We become like children when we truly aspire for knowledge proper. And then it is perhaps that truth reveals itself before us. As I mentioned, the Vedas and the Upanishads particularly are regarded in this country especially as specimens of the highest type of spiritual revelation. They are called Prabhu Samhita in ancient Sanskrit technical parlance, by which what is meant is that the Vedas and the Upanishads go directly into the heart of truth without mincing matters, without telling you stories, without giving you comparisons, analogies, anecdotes, and diversions of any kind. And they give you a command as to the nature of truth. And this command aspect of their approach is what makes them get designated as Prabhu Samhita. Prabhu is a lord, a master. He does not tell you stories. A master is very strict. And he tells you immediately as to what he requires of you. Do this, go here. That is all. It is a direct instruction and a mandate upon you. So the Vedas and the Upanishads give us a mandate, a command and an order, like a medical prescription which is direct and precise, scientific. But we live in a world of varieties. We see many things which we do not understand, but which attract our attention and demand an explanation of us. We have to confront them. When we are ready to follow the mandate of the Vedas and the Upanishads, we are also faced with certain side issues which arise on account of certain peculiarities in our own individual nature. We have a psychological setup. We are psychological beings. Man is especially a unit of an immense psychological complex, and thus needs to be approached from the point of view of this complex of which he is made. The Vedas and the Upanishads are great masters indeed, no doubt. But we seem to be in need of a person, a type of guidance which will not only instruct us, direct us, or order us to do certain things, but also appreciate the position in which we are. There are difficulties which are purely personal, which each one knows for one's own self. A master has his own problems and a servant has his own problems. Apart from the fact that you are a master or a servant, you are also a human being. You are also an individual with a private life of your own. When we live a purely scientific life of precision, a life which is strictly in obedience to law, regulation and rule, as the Vedas and the Upanishads would expect us, we have at the same time very silent whisperings from within our own selves, speaking in a tone that is mild and yet incapable of being neglected. We have what is called an emotional aspect in our personality, apart from the purely psychological constitution which has created a setup of its own, which goes by various names as society, a world of nature, family, personality and the like. This very important aspect of human nature was taken notice of by our ancient masters, and they, to our own great advantage, condescended to present this masterly wisdom of the Vedas and the Upanishads in a manner that is humanly appreciable and intelligible. We have three strata of knowledge which we call the Prasthana Traya. Traya means triple or threefold text, and Prasthana is a stage. We have a threefold stage of learning, philosophical and spiritual. One of these, one aspect of this threefold approach to knowledge is constituted of the Vedas and the Upanishads. That is one of the stages or the prasthanas, the rungs you may call it, of this integral knowledge. Another rung, another aspect or facet of this knowledge, another approach to it, is constituted by what is traditionally known as the Vedanta Sutra or the Brahma Sutra, whose approach is rationalistic, intellectual, logical, polemic, argumentative, the purpose of which is to establish by polemical argumentative methods the intuitive declarations of truth as recorded in the Vedas and the Upanishads. So these are two aspects of this triple approach: the Vedas and the Upanishads on one side, the polemical Vedantic literature represented by the Brahma Sutras on the other side. But we have a third aspect which is represented in the epics, especially the Mahabharata, whose quintessence is what is called the Bhagavad Gita. As a matter of fact, the Prasthanatraya is constituted of the Upanishads, the Brahma Sutras and the Bhagavad Gita. These three sum up the entire spiritual wisdom of India. While the Upanishads and the Vedas, as I pointed out, are direct in their approach to the naked truth of things, and while the polemical literature of a logical type is rationalistic in its approach, the Bhagavad Gita, which is a beautiful pendant in the garland of the Mahabharata, is of a different type altogether, about which I propose to speak to you for some time, inasmuch as The Bhagavad Gita is not only a philosophical guide in our spiritual existence, but also a practical handbook, a searchlight, as it were, flooded on the path which we have to tread in the practice of yoga. The Bhagavad Gita has been regarded as perhaps the most comprehensive of scriptures in yoga, because it touches all aspects of human life in all its stages and levels. It is considered as a metaphysical text, a practical scripture of yoga, as well as a mystical compendium meant for leading an inner life of the spirit. So it is almost everything for a sadhaka. There cannot be a better guide for you than the Bhagavad Gita in your practical spiritual life and your life of yoga sadhana. Because, as a famous verse has it, the Bhagavad Gita is not an independent approach in its own manner, but is something like a milk of the Upanishads. It is said that if the Upanishads are cows, the Bhagavad Gita is the milk of these cows. Bhagavan Sri Krishna is the milkman. Arjuna is the calf. Such is the comparison made to evaluate the greatness and the importance of this great text called the Bhagavad Gita. This wonderful scriptural guide for us, the Bhagavad Gita, occurs in the middle of a famous epic called the Mahabharata. It is unfortunate that students of Indian literature rarely study these textbooks, because they have a wrong notion that Indian philosophy means Upanishads, Acharya Shankara, Ramanuja, Madhva, etc. But in the Mahabharata there is a very pertinent saying which makes out that the Vedas are afraid of people who have not studied these expositions like the Mahabharata and the Gita, because it is these texts that tell you what the Vedas really mean. Bibhetyalpashrutadvedo mamayam praharishyati. The Vedas tell, it seems, oh, this gentleman is coming to kill us because he cannot understand us. As the Vedas are revelations of eternal truth, they comprehend all aspects of life, and it is next to impossibility for the human intellect to deeply gauge what is all comprehensive. We never approach life in an all-comprehensive manner at any time. We have only certain roots struck for our practical purposes, and we completely ignore aspects which are not concerned with our pragmatic approach to things. But that precisely is the reason why we fail in our life. We cannot have that sort of parochial approach to things, where things are internally related to one another, a fact which will come to relief when we go deep into the structure. The life of the human being is a vast field of activity and confrontation of forces. Life is activity. It is nothing but that. and everyone knows what it means. This activity is impulsive and sometimes compulsive. You are obliged to act in a particular manner. You have a choice to pinpoint certain types of activity, but you have no choice whether to be active or not to be active. That you have to act and work and toil seems to be written on your foreheads, and no one can escape this predicament. But you have a freedom to choose what type of work is suitable to your temperament and your practical needs of life. This is no doubt the actual position and situation. But we bungle in the choice of duty. While we are compelled to work from morning till evening, right from our childhood, we are not sufficiently endowed with the understanding necessary for choosing what is actually good for us. A distinction is made between what is good for us and what is pleasant for us. Most of us pursue what is pleasant for us, but we do not know what is good for us. Because what is called the pleasant, the prayas as they put it, is immediately attractive to the senses and the sensations of our body. And we being completely enmeshed in body sensation and a social type of relationship, we immediately jump into those circumstances which promises social satisfaction and sensational pleasures. This is unfortunate again. Pitiable is the condition of that person who thinks that the pleasures that the ego can evoke through social relationship and the pleasures that the senses can evoke through contact with objects are the be-all and the end-all of life. We have two great problems in life, the senses and the ego. These are terrible masters of us. We cannot satisfy them, they are devils indeed. However much you may feed them, their hunger seems to be insatiable. Go on feeding the senses, they go on burning like conflagration more and more. You go on feeding your ego, the stouter and the fatter it becomes, the more you try to pamper it. We have no other difficulty in life, only these are the difficulties, our senses and our egoism. But these are not what is good for us. The ego does not give us what is good nor promise what is good. And the senses, of course, are worse. Still, the great masters whose revelations are recorded in the scriptures are intent upon the good of man rather than merely pampering to his temporal needs. They are real mothers and fathers for us. While our physical parents have given birth to this visible body of ours and taken care of it for some time in their own manner, these are the real parents, the great sages who take care of our inner life. Because our life is not exhausted by the physical body of social relationships merely. Our life continues beyond the grave. We live beyond death. We have a life transcending physical relationships and sensory contacts. If you depend on only those factors which give pleasure to the ego and the senses, and ignore those factors which are necessary for the sustenance of our inner life, What will happen to us when we quit this world? Who will take care of us? These sensations, these masters who have pampered the ego are not going to help us anymore. Certain other things will come before us, who will be absolute strangers before us, whom we have completely ignored in our present life, on whom we may have to depend entirely. Do you know this? After we leave this body, where will we go? Who will help us? Who are going to be our friends? We do not know. But is it fair on our part to completely neglect those essentials which are going to be our real sustenance in our future life and hang on only those temporary factors which are regarded as necessary for a physical existence in this short span of life? Is this knowledge? Is this culture? Is this wisdom? So, the ancient masters have hammered into our mind in these scriptures that we should not run after pleasure merely of the ego or the senses, the prayers, but should be able to devote a little time for the shreyas or the blessedness of what we really are essentially in our inner life. This was the mission of a great master called Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasa, who wrote the Mahabharata, who recorded the Bhagavad Gita for us, blessed be his name. And his writings are so all-comprehensive that an old adage says, Vyasochishtam Jagat Sarvam. Whatever is there in this world is nothing but that which is vomited by Vyasa. You cannot say anything which he has not said. There is nothing in the world of knowledge which Vyasa has not written. Particularly in his masterpiece called the Mahabharata, which is the quintessence of the Vedas and the Upanishads in an expository and epic fashion. Yadi hasti tadanyatra, yanne hasti na tatkvajita. He said of the Mahabharata and the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, whatever is there is anywhere else, and whatever you cannot find there, you will not find anywhere. Such is the vastness, the depth and the comprehensiveness of this writing of Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasa, the author of the Mahabharata, the editor of the Vedas. He is called Vyasa because he edited the Vedas. He is called Veda Vyasa. He did not merely write the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita. He was the classifier of the Vedas in their present form and so called Veda Vyasa, an omniscient sage of incredible power of yogic knowledge. And such a master has given us this wonderful epic of spiritual life called the Mahabharata. It is not a story or an analogy or an anecdote, but a dramatic presentation of life in its picturesque form. Whatever Shakespeare has written is of a similar nature. They are not telling us stories. They present human nature in its true color and true form. And in a more splendid fashion has Vyasa done this work in the Mahabharata, in the Bhagavad Gita. The different facets of human life with their passions and prejudices, with their longings and aspirations, with their problems and difficulties, together with their solutions, are all presented to us in this masterly work of Vyasa. And the Bhagavad Gita may be regarded as the focused point of the Mahabharata. The focusing point of the entire teaching of this epic is the Bhagavad Gita, from where you have approach or access into the various palatial edifices
he has built for us in the form of the personality of the epic. The great masters, Bhishma and Drona, Bhima and Arjuna, Yudhishthira, and above all, the great personality of Krishna, which runs like a silken thread through the entire garland of the Mahabharata. All these are to stir our inner spirit to action in practical life and to enable us to see reality in the visible things of the world. Awaken us into facts from the slumber of our ignorance and din into our ears the great message that the visible is not the whole of reality. The larger part of reality is invisible to your eyes. To approach truth, to have a vision of reality, to know the true nature of our own selves, we have to adopt this philosophical foundation, this psychological approach and this practical technique which is embodied in the Bhagavad Gita. As I mentioned a few minutes before, because it is a metaphysical text, it is a practical exposition of yoga in its many-sidedness, and it is also a record of mystical experiences of the highest reaches of the human soul. So, nothing could be better than to endeavor to understand what this message of the Bhagavad Gita is for a student of yoga, a student of culture, a student of philosophy, and an aspirant after God realization. The outward setting of the Bhagavad Gita is the historical stage of the Mahabharata. I mentioned to you in the very beginning that these great masters adopted a triple approach: the outward, the inward, and the universal. So when we study the Vedas or the Upanishads or a yogic text or the Mahabharata or the Bhagavad Gita, we have to adopt this triple method of interpretation: the outward setting of the whole drama and the inner facts of this enactment, and finally the outcome of it, namely the fruit of universal realization. The Bhagavad Gita takes us along this route of a triple understanding of nature, God, and man together in their blending and integrality. The outer setting is the historical scene, wherein we are told two forces are arrayed for a battle that was to take place. Everywhere you will find two forces, whether it is outwardly in the world or inwardly in your own self. Even in your own family, a small unit of a few members, you will find two forces working. Everywhere you will find this. Even in your own heart, in your own mind, you will find these two forces working. Sometimes one voice speaking, another time another voice speaking. You yourself will have a double message from your own self inwardly. So these two forces are arrayed. And in the epic language, these forces are called the Pandava forces and the Kaurava forces. The positive and the negatives confronting each other to fight out a battle for a different purpose altogether. And these forces are represented by certain units, commanding powers, whose orders were to be obeyed by all the subordinates. Now, in the very beginning of the epic, before the commencement of the scene of the war, we are told that both the leaders of the two forces, collected immense strength, army and support from various corners of the country, and one of the towering personalities those times, towering both in knowledge and power, was Shri Krishna. And the leaders of the two parties are said to have approached him for help. This introduction is provided to us in the Mahabharata before the commencement of the war and the exposition of the Bhagavad Gita. He was an impartial person, not belonging to any side. His palace or fortress was in Dwaraka, and the history tells us that the leader of the Pandavas, Arjuna, and the leader of the other party, Kauravas, Duryodhana, both approached this mighty man, Krishna, for help in this ensuing war. Very beautifully the story is told to us, with a tremendous spiritual message behind it. It is said that Shri Krishna was reclining, having a nap, perhaps on his couch in his palace in Dwaraka, when these two gentlemen approached. Out of the two, Arjuna was a humble, childlike person, simple in his nature. Duryodhana was a proud man, very self-confident and arrogant in his approach. He always regarded himself as a ruler. He was a king, of course, no doubt. He was the king of the country. And so, befitting the status of a king, he occupied a chair near the head of Krishna and sat there, while Krishna was relaxing and was dozing. And Arjuna, as a simple man, humble, stood at the feet of Krishna. He didn't occupy a chair. He didn't even sit. He stood there. After a few minutes, it is said, Krishna woke up and opened his eyes and saw naturally the person who was standing at his feet. You won't turn your back and see what is behind you. He opened his eyes and suddenly saw Arjuna. My dear friend, what makes you come at this hour? What do you want from me? How is it that you have taken so much pains to come from long distance, from New Delhi, from Indraprastha, you have come to Dwaraka? Then immediately a gentleman from behind, sir, I have come first. Like this. Oh, Duryodhana, you have also come. What is the matter? Then Arjuna said nothing. Duryodhana said, sir, perhaps you are already aware, there is an unfortunate situation that has arisen. There is a likelihood of a war between us. It cannot be avoided for reasons obvious. I have come for help. You are an impartial man. You have no friends and enemies. I want your help. I see, said Krishna, you have come for that. Arjuna, what is your errand? Master, I have come for the same purpose. I want your blessing. I want your help in whatever way possible. Well, Krishna said, what can I tell you? Both of you have come for the same purpose. I have nothing with me except an army. Of course, it is a very large army, a very powerful army, almost invincible army, I should say. It is called the Narayani Sena. I can lend this army to any one of you. And the other thing left is myself. There is nothing else. The whole army and myself. Army will fight till death. And I can offer this to you. But I will not fight. I will come to you as a guest. Eat your meal and sit quiet. I will sit there. I will give you any kind of moral support, but physically I will not take weapons, and I will not take active part in the war, and I shall be a single man. There will be nobody else with me. So you can choose. You can choose me single, doing nothing, not taking any active part, or you choose the large army which is very fierce in its attack. Duryodhana said, the choice must be left to me first, sir, because I have come first. Krishna said, friend, you have come first, perhaps you have come first, I don't know, maybe, but I saw Arjuna first. So, offer the choice first to Arjuna, you choose afterwards. So, it was not pleasing to Duryodhana. Not good, I am a king and this is how I am treated. All right, he didn't say anything, he can't say anything. Arjuna, what do you want now between these two things? A single person like me doing nothing, taking no active part, or the fierce army of mine, Narayana Sena, which you want? Master, I want you only. Duryodhana said, oh, I have won the game. This fool has chosen the wrong thing. I carry the butter and the ghee and he carries the buttermilk. Because Duryodhana was afraid that perhaps this gentleman may say, I want the army, then whole thing is finished. And the very purpose of coming is foiled. But he thought, stupid as Arjuna was, he chose this inactive man who would do nothing, who will only be a liability in his house. Duryodhana said, sir, I want the army. All right, so it is now clear. Duryodhana went in great confidence, thinking that he had already won victory in the war. The victory is already mine, it is decided. There is no need of saying anything about it. Because such an army is mine. Foolish Pandavas, stupid Arjuna, he said within himself, and went back and told his kinsmen in Hastinapura, don't bother, victory is ours. This is what has happened, he told. Oh, all were happy, they made a bhandara. So we are going to win the war. Oh, these Pandavas are going to be defeated. They have no help. After Duryodhana left, Krishna asked Arjuna, how foolish you are, my friend. Why have you chosen me instead of asking for the army? What do you get from me? Are you not unwise? Have you not made a mistake? Arjuna said, Lord, I want only your blessings and your very presence is sufficient for me. I have not come here to trouble you or take anything from you. I have come only for your benign grace and blessings. If you merely utter a word, victory be yours, that shall be sufficient for me. Should I want an army? You please be with me as my moral support, spiritual guide, friend and philosopher. I need nothing else from you. I see, this is your intention. All right, so be it, said Krishna and bade farewell to Arjuna. Arjuna went back and told Yudhishthira, his elder brother, what happened. They were very happy that the Lord is coming. Whether he may actively taking part in the war or not is a different matter. But why did Arjuna choose Krishna, the single man, inactive person, rather than the active war warriors known as the Narayani Sena? Because here we have the secret of success in life. And here also is the clue to failures in life. Why do we fail in life and why do some people succeed in life? Well, the answer is here in this beautiful story. Why did Duryodhana choose the army? Why did Arjuna choose Krishna? Many of us are Duryodhanas, choosing only the army. Because we do not want that inactive something which is one. We want many. You always ask for many things and not one thing. This is the way in which we think always.
You accost any person, how many things you want, he will say many things. Nobody will be satisfied with one thing. But we make a mistake of thinking that one is inferior to the many, less than the many. Because we are given the arithmetic that many ones are larger in quantity than a single one. That is our mathematics. Well, very clear it is. $100 are larger than $1. Is it not clear? So naturally, many things will be more useful than one thing. This was what Duryodhana thought. This is what every one of us also thinks. And this is why we are in this unfortunate, helpless, weakened position we call mortal existence, mortal life. But there is a peculiar one thing which cannot be arithmetically or mathematically computed. Our arithmetic will not work there. There is a super mathematical world of realities transcending the calculative mind of the human individual. Calculations of ours will not work there. Many things are not larger than one thing there. And many one things do not make several things. How is it possible? Because there is something which is not measurable through the yardstick of space and time, which is within us and also outside in the world. And the quantitative approach to things, which is called arithmetic or mathematics, is inapplicable in that purely qualitative realm of truth. Truth is not merely a quality also. We cannot use terms of this kind in its respect. It is neither a quantity nor a quality. It is something transcending both. But anyhow, it is not a quantity. It is not an aggregate of particulars. It is not an army of soldiers. It is not a group of forces. It is not a totality of individuals. It is, in short, not a measurable something. And therefore, the whole army of Duryodhana can do nothing with it. It is useless to measure its strength by comparing it with the powers of the world. That one thing is a non-mathematical unit. And that was represented by this one man called Krishna. He was not a single individual. He was not one man sitting in Dwaraka, which was the wrong opinion of Duryodhana and others. He was a non-mathematical unit, which is beyond the understanding of human mind, because we cannot think except in terms of arithmetic. All our understanding, business, transaction, give, take, business, everything is calculated on this basis. The more you take away, the less the source is. That's why we don't want to give anything. We are greedy, very miserly. Charity is very painful to us. What is charity? Giving away what you have. And what happens to you? You lose what you already have. So losing is not a good thing. We, through our business arithmetic, conclude that the more you take away from yourself, the less do you become in your status and quality. But this is not the truth. It is far from the truth. The more you take away from yourself, the larger do you become. How is it possible? This is contrary to all known arithmetic. But the nature of truth, unfortunately for us, is contrary to everything that we know and we can appreciate and we can regard as useful. It is because of this enigmatic and supernormal character of truth, we do not want truth. We always bid goodbye to it and want to relegate it to the limbo and try to think of it at our leisure hours. Truth is very unattractive. It is not pleasing.
When it comes also, it comes like a pain or a sorrow to us, like an unwanted guest. We like only the world of quantities, of particulars, of magnitude, of wealth, of prayers, of pressure. Now the realm of the spirit, the path of yoga, the way of spiritual, is quite different from this quantitative interpretation of things. We have to shed completely this prejudice of thinking in terms of business and transaction. All our thinking is transaction and business, give and take. It is purely a measurement through quantity. And truth is not a quantity measurable in terms of the things of the world or any value of the world. It is this difficulty that prevents most people from approaching life spiritual. It is shocking. The very thought of God shocks us because of the feeling that perhaps we are going to lose all the pleasure centers of our life. But blessed souls like Arjuna, who knew what this non-quantitative reality is, represented in the historical scene of the Mahabharata as Krishna, and the universal setup of things as the Supreme Being, the Absolute. That should be the measuring rod for us in the evaluation of anything in this world. For the Pandavas, for Arjuna, for Yudhishthira, Krishna was everything. Whenever there was any difficulty, they will turn to him for advice. Whatever he says was final. Why should you regard the opinion of one man as final, as if he is the only man in the whole world? But he was not a man in the quantitative, social, unitary sense. It was not an individual. It was a super individual power that was embodied in an individual form. And if we also consult with this super individual value in this life, we will certainly succeed in life. But we consult these particulars which tempt us with their promises of sensory gratification, and so we fail. All masters of quantity fail in this world. All the dictators, all the tyrants that history has seen were worshippers of quantity. And doom came upon them. They were wiped out of the earth. In spite of their being masters of the largest quantity thinkable, owners of immense wealth and rulers of vast kingdoms, but they were pounded to dust by the relentless hands of time. Because truth is quite different from man, what man contemplates as true or real. So the spiritual evaluation of things is the subject of the Bhagavad Gita, which is different from the normal childish way of thinking of ours in terms of give and take, quantity, money, social status and pleasures of sense and ego. We are entering a new realm altogether, a new world of a different type of light and resplendence. It is awakening from sleep, as it were, into the world of bright sunlight. We will be taken into a wonderland by the Bhagavad Gita with its masterly message of the spirit. Hari Om Tat Sat.